know my first guest from his role as Fiddler in the 1977 miniseries Roots, for which he won a Emmy Award, or you might know him from his Academy Award-winning role for Best Supporting Actor in the 1982 film An Officer and a Gentleman, in which he played Gunnery Sergeant Emil Foley. You may also know him from the stage in such roles as A Raisin in the Sun and The Blacks. He's in a new series. It's a CBC adaptation of Lawrence Hill's book, The Book of Negroes, and he plays the role of Daddy Moses. I had the privilege of speaking with Louis Gossett Jr. over the phone on Wednesday.
Well,
it's a real privilege to be joined on the phone today by Oscar and Emmy-winning actor Louis Gossett Jr. Louis, thank you so much for being on the show today.
It's my pleasure. And you're in Vancouver, one of my favorite places in the world.
Well, thank you. It's certainly a lovely town to live in.
Right.
I wanted to have you on because you're in the new the Book of Negroes miniseries, which was one of my favorite books that I read a couple years back.
Right.
Why did you want to be involved in a project like Book of Negroes?
Well, at first, it's a highly historical thing. I started in Roots, and I did the audiobook of 12 Years a Slave. And up in Canada, I did the James Mink story, which is very similar. And it's not this one is a comprehensive story. It's got slavery in the background. It's got atrocities in the background. But it's really a triumphant story of a woman's life. And it was a no-brainer to ask to be included. So they were looking for me, and I was looking for them. And then was the wonderful relationship with BET.
And you know, we mentioned Roots off the top there, and of course that was sort of where you first became known to a wide audience. Do you see a lot of similarities between Roots and Book of Negroes? Would you say that Book of Negroes is sort of the Roots for a new generation, in a sense?
It really is the Roots for a new generation. It's comprehensive because it's a real personal. That was Kunta Kinte. This is Aminata. And it's a true story. There's so many stories like that. But before we go to the next level to talk about other experiences about us as a people, this is the comprehensive six-hour story of this triumphant woman who made all of the journeys. She was sometimes a slave, sometimes she was not. But all the things that happened to her, having babies and losing them and getting married, the whole thing, it's completely dramatic. So it's more than Roots. It's more than 12 Years a Slave. This is a human woman who happens to be black, coming out of Sierra Leone and going through this experience. So it transverses slavery and Roots, and it tells the story at the same time. So this is a comprehensive story. Now, that makes it totally entertaining and totally riveting. You follow her all the way through in 6 hours.
You know, with this series and with a movie like 12 Years a Slave, it seems as if Hollywood or the people that make movies are ready to tackle these issues again. Why do you think that is? Can you pinpoint a certain something that perhaps made Hollywood ready to dive down this area again?
One word: the internet. Things that would happen in the history that we conveniently kind of put out of the way. Things that we didn't know, we now know in the internet. Nobody can do anything without people knowing it, and it comes proper time for a tapestry of all kinds of people to be sensitive to one another. We have a bigger issue, and the bigger issue is the salvation of the planet and other things about cleaning the air up and taking care of our children. So this is the comprehensive story in Hollywood. The most sensitive people around in our society are sensitive enough to know that this is a story that people want to see. Plus, of course, it makes money.
Yeah, and you know, this book was such a big phenomenon here in Canada when it first came out. And Lawrence Hill, the writer of the book, I understand, also helped or was heavily involved in the production of the miniseries.
Yes, quite a brilliant man.
What was it like for you as an actor to have him being the writer of the book actually involved in the adaptation of it?
Well, it's a through line, and it's much more of a through line from him to the producers, for him staying involved with the writing of it and keeping the decency and the clarity of what he wrote in the book to see it translated on the stage, and he had his hands on all the way through. That's a wonderful thing.
Now, you play the character of
Daddy Moses.
Daddy Moses, yes. How would for our listeners who may not be familiar with or as familiar with the book or the series, how would you describe that character?
In Roots ways, that's the fiddler of the series, and he's responsible for leading these people to the promised land in Nova Scotia. He started this first church. The church is thriving today in Nova Scotia, but he is the man who led those people there.
Now, you've done Roots, you've done Negroes, you've done 12 Years of Slaves, and you've done a lot of other films, but is there a certain type of role or a certain type of story that you find particularly appealing to your senses?
Well, I like the challenge, that's number one. And the challenge, like an Enemy Mine or Daddy Moses playing somebody who has to keep the fact that he's partially blind out of the people's minds, or the one having to work out so hard at over 40 years old to play an officer and gentleman and an Enemy Mine, but it's 6 hours of makeup. I like the challenge because it forces you into the character. The other thing is if it's rewarding to the audience. So that could be comedy, it could be drama, it could be action, but as long as it's a stretch and a continuum of my career. So I don't like to be typed as much, but I just like to do something that's challenging.
Blindness is always one of the hardest abilities or disabilities for an actor to portray. How do you get into that mindset?
Well, this character was it's a tough one. My favorite person who played blind, a couple of them, but Al Pacino in The Scent of a Woman was outstanding when he did it. I learned a little bit about what he did, but if you're blind for that long, and I chose for him to have been blind almost since birth, he can see, but he had a fever, so he was able to see certain things. And he can see about 5 feet out of one eye. So in order to keep people from knowing that, except the people he wants to know it, he acts as if he can see, because he has adjusted himself. There's an adjustment happens with the human beings when they have defects of character. Stevie Wonder can see better than anybody I know. Some of the people who have lost their limbs or can't speak, they overcompensate for some wonderful reason, and they become quite eloquent. And this guy, Daddy Moses, is able to maneuver pretty good with his limited vision.
In many ways, is it almost a blessing for Daddy Moses to be partially blind, because then he cannot see the atrocities of what is happening to his people, or is it a hindrance?
Well, it does. Well, when you look at the last scene when he finds out what's going on, there is a feeling. His feelings become deeper. So there's an overcompensation with his inability to see. He sees better that way because he can feel. His hands are much more expressive, and his feelings are much more in his fingertips, and that's why he says this wonderful relationship with Aminata. It's quite a touching relationship.
You've won many accolades over your life. You won the Emmy for Roots. You won the Best Supporting Actor Oscar for Officer and a Gentleman. But do you ever think how different your life would have been if you had accepted that basketball scholarship?
Well, I got the basketball scholarship. I was invited to the New York Knicks rookie camp, but I was already starting rehearsal with A Raisin in the Sun. And so my bowl burst when I went up there and I saw all these hungry young men fighting tooth and nail to get this job and paying much less money than I was already making. So it was a no-brainer. So I wouldn't have accepted it. All up until that particular time, I wanted to be a basketball player, but I didn't use enough time to be a professional, responsible, professional athlete. But God put something else in my face, and I had more money in my pocket than the average basketball player had in the bank. it's a different ballgame today, so I might have made a different decision. But then it was a no-brainer to do Raisin in the Sun and continue my serious gift that I got as an actor.
And I know that you only took an acting class because of a sports injury. Do you remember?
It wasn't even an acting class. It was a sports injury. Then I started to do a little extra stuff for my English teacher, Gus Bloom. And he saw something in my monologues that I was doing in class. So he said, they're looking for somebody. They can't find somebody to play this lead in this Broadway show. Why don't you tell your mother to take you down there? You can't lose anything. Just go. And that's how I got in the show business.
Do you remember that first audition that you had?
It wasn't. Yeah, I remember it very, very clearly because I came up on the stage and there was one single light on the stage, and I could not see anybody in the theater. And they started to giggle at me, and my feelings were hurt. And I walked out, and then going down the street, a man stopped me. And he said, "We weren't laughing at you. We were laughing because you looked so much like I did when I was your age, and I was the author of the play, Lou Peterson." And then he pulled me back, and to make a long story short, I did get that part, and I opened at the age of 17 on Broadway in a lead, in a play I had never seen a play, in a lead after the end of that summer in 1953, in a lead and Take a Giant Step, it was called.
Wow. I read an article recently, I think it was in the New York Times, where a writer wrote that the reason why a lot of African-American actors are starting to get recognized, and this isn't always true, but particularly in roles like 12 Years a Slave and Ray, is that they're getting recognized for roles that couldn't possibly be played by a non-black actor. What are your feelings about a saying like that?
Well, it's a very ironic thing that's happening. It's not only African-American actors. In 12 Years a Slave, that was Chiwetel Okafor, and he's English, and he was able to play this character. Quite a brilliant actor, Chiwetel. And then, of course, in Selma, David and the wife who played his wife, they're both from England. And Steve McQueen directed 12 Years a Slave, and he's from Britain. So, and then you've got Idris Elba, who comes out of England. So I think they studied hard. They studied at the Royal Academy or something, but their quality in the theater probably makes them kind of exceptional. Here in America, we have some outstanding actors and actresses, but now is the time. The time has come to tell all the stories about our people here in this country. Everybody must know everything about one another. So it's the next natural step. My dream is the next natural step to go continue on with this African-American legacy, and maybe the Harlem Renaissance, that our cowboys and wars, and so that we know everything about everyone else, and there's more sensitivity rather than friction. We need to know because we have a bigger picture to take care of. We have to take care of this planet and its weather and its fresh air and its fresh water, and be a lesson and example for our children. And that's everybody. We're going into a global society. And we need to be sensitive that if something's hurting on one side of the planet, it's hurting on this side of the planet. It's like a wave. I have a foundation called the E-Racism Foundation to try and teach children those values.
Now, you were the, believe if I'm correct, you were the first African-American actor to win Best Supporting Actor. And the
first African-American man.
And the second...
any Oscar.
Yeah. And the second African-American man to win an Oscar overall. What?
First African-American man, because Sidney Poitier is Bahamian.
Yes, right. What does that mean to you as an actor?
It means something very special. It's a piece of history. It carries with it an inhuman responsibility from time to time, because then you have to behave a certain way. You can't be human. And I grapple with that almost daily. Until here recently, I've made a piece to be just me, who I am, good and bad, and there's a freedom in that decision.
They talk a little bit about the Oscar curse, you know, because when you win the Oscar, you can't go any higher. Was that something that you had struggled with, or you found
well,
affected you in any way?
The curse. Yeah, well, I struggled with the Oscar curse because after I got the Oscar, there was no work. It took a minute for people to try it. And thank God for television, because I worked a lot on television. But it happens, but it's not happening here recently. I see Robert Downey Jr., he has gotten an Oscar, but I see all these Oscar winners they get enough money to last for a year, and they can come relax, and they do the projects that they like, the Tommy Lee Joneses and Kevin Costners and the George Clooney's. They're my heroes. They're the ones I respect. Sean Penn, Angelina, Brad Pitt, all of those guys are really very decent human beings, and they're doing relevant projects, and I highly respect them, and I'd like to be part of that crowd.
Speaking of television, are you going to pop up in season 2 of Extant?
Yes, I'll be in about episode 3 or 4. They're revamping it. Some people are gone, some people are coming back, and some new people are being included. So I know I'm part of the family, and one of the people I mentor is the wonderful Halle Berry, who I love to work with. And so she'll make sure that Daddy's going to be there.
Television is one area that's just changed so rapidly over the last few years, and we're seeing some of the best work on television, and all these award-winning actors like yourself and Halle Berry are doing television. What do you like about television, and what can it afford an actor that maybe films can't?
Well, it's constant work. It's weekly. It's a bigger challenge, but television is growing up in its content. It's got the finger on the pulse of the public, and sometimes it gets a little fickle. But in all, it's getting quite relevant on all the networks and all the cables. We're doing stuff that in the past would only happen in feature films. So now it's very attractive to some movie stars to possibly go and do a television series.
Book of Negroes seems to be a very timely series in a way, because we're seeing a lot of struggles, I guess, in certain parts of the States. You know, there was the Michael Brown case, and then there was Eric Garner. What needs to happen in order for that sort of mob mentality to change?
Well, we have to be careful. If we call a so-called minority, we have to be careful. What we take into our system and the system of mob mentality is old rules. I learned my lessons, some of them from Dr. King, a great deal from Nelson Mandela, who, if anybody had a reason to really be violent, it would have been him after 27 years of imprisonment. But he took the time to find out that there is a much bigger picture. And the bigger picture is a two-sided coin of responsibility. On our neighborhood, the black neighborhood, that has to be the most pleasant neighborhood for people to come. In order for that to happen, we need to mentor our children, give them the responsibilities, pay attention to them, because that's what they're asking for, and create these holistic members, ambassadors of holistic peace, so that that neighborhood is people can visit without fear. They can come to our restaurants, eat our food, listen to our music, imbibe them in our culture, bring their businesses, and invest. And then the police will back off a little bit, so that friction thing must be separated. The person who can do that is the ones people are afraid of. They're afraid of our growth. It is our responsibility to allay that fear so we can both get along for the bigger picture.
You mentioned people like, you know, Mandela, Dr. King, and all these world leaders. And I know you yourself actually played the president in Left Behind. And then, you know, a few years after that, Obama gets elected. As you know, as someone who, you know, is a prominent African American who grew up in the in that turbulent civil rights era, what was it like for you to witness that? Witness the election of Barack Obama.
Oh, it was an enormous catharsis. I was in the lawn, looking up at about a 45-degree angle when he put his hand on the Bible, corrected him, and he started again. And I saw Michelle looking at him and looking at the Bible and listening to the words. And when he finally took his hand off the Bible, I was with Cicely Tyson. We both collapsed, and it was like a movie of fast forward. You know, when a movie goes fast, all of the atrocities, all the stuff that was personal that happened to us, all the lynchings, all the stuff, it was like a movie coming out of my mind. And we were sobbing. We didn't know it. And we got up and started hugging people. It was a complete eruption of emotion. And today, I am so proud that man is in the White House. I'm so proud of what he does and how he thinks and how he raises his family. He is a man of history, and I support him 100%.
So finally, just to wrap things up here, getting back to Book of Negroes, for the people who watch this series, and I guess predominantly younger people of my generation who may not be as familiar with some of the history that's talked about, What do you want them ultimately to take away from that piece of work?
From the Book of Negroes?
Yeah.
Well, just more information and more information about our feelings and our history. And there's so much more to say. So I want them to come back after seeing Book of Negroes, hungry for more.
Well, Book of Negroes is a great book, and it's a fantastic miniseries, and it airs on the CBC here in Canada. And Louis Gossett Jr. plays the role of Daddy Moses in the Book of Negroes. Louis Gossett Jr., thank you so much for coming on the show today. You've given us here at Community Radio a real boost.
All right. Tell everybody Joe Forties. I'll see them soon.
Alrighty. Thank you very much. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. But right now, you know my first guest as the former host of The Fifth Estate, which he co-hosted for 24 years and won 10 Gemini Awards for his distinguished work as an investigative broadcast journalist. In his later years, he's also become an author, and his first novel, The Long Stretch, was nominated for a CBA Libris Award. He followed that with a memoir, Causeway, A Passage from Innocence, which won both the Edna Stabler Award for Creative Nonfiction as well as the Evelyn Richardson Prize. It was his second novel, however, The Bishop's Man, that really made him known as a writer. It was a number one national bestseller and won the prestigious Scotiabank Giller Prize, as well as the Dartmouth Book Award and the CBA Libris Fiction Book of the Year Award. There was a final book in that Loose-Knit trilogy, Why Men Lie, which was also a number one national bestseller. His new novel is Punishment, and he is the wonderful Lyndon McIntyre, and I had the chance to speak with him about his book on Wednesday. Well, it's a privilege to be joined on the phone by 10 times, yes, that's 10-time Gemini Award winner and Scotiabank Giller Prize Award winner for fiction, Lyndon McIntyre. Hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Well, it's great to be here.
So your new novel is Punishment. How did the origin of this story start for you, would you say?
Well, I've been in journalism for 50 years. It sounds like an awful thing to say, but that's how long I was there. And in journalism, you spend an awful lot of time doing stories that bring you up close to the justice system. The commission of crimes, a lot of serious crimes, the function of the courts. And in my case, I ended up visiting a lot of, getting to know a lot of inmates in prisons across the country, all the way from, Nova Scotia to Victoria, B.C., to William Head. I've been in a lot of them. I've met a lot of people, had a lot of interesting conversations with inmates. Invariably, they are interesting people. Invariably, they are there for extremely complicated reasons. It's almost painfully and criminally simple to say they're in there because they're bad. They're in there because their lives are complex, and they're complex, and they've done bad things. So I've always sort of wanted to explore that in greater sort of detail than the journalism allowed. Journalism, you got a few minutes, you got a few hundred words, and you kind of got to get it in there. And so you take the top layer off, and then the rest is there. So I wanted to do a story about what happens when emotion replaces reason and prejudice replaces facts in the pursuit of justice. And that's an old story, lots of illustrations of what happens, but I decided I would try to do it in the context of the great international mission to get Saddam Hussein and to invade Iraq. And I would sort of have that playing out as a backdrop, and then at the other end of the spectrum I'd have this ugly little incident in a very small place, and people get riled up and they become manipulated by a sort of a Bush-Cheney clone, and the results are tragic at both ends of the scale.
Is fiction for you different from nonfiction in the way you approach both the content and writing process of it?
Well, it's all storytelling. It's just storytelling from a different point of view. Actually, writing factual stuff is easier than fiction because you don't have to invent. As a matter of fact, you're not supposed to invent a whole lot. It depends. I mean, if you're writing a memoir, you have more flexibility to be creative. If you're writing a hard and fast factual book, or a news story, or you're doing a documentary, you have to get as close as possible to that elusive goal of objectivity and truth. And objectivity, 100% objectivity, is impossible, even probably for a robot. But you strive for that. On the other end of the scale, fiction or literature, you gather up all sorts of material and you shape it into a truthful narrative that will deliver reality just in a different kind of a package. And in some ways, fiction allows you to get closer to reality, get closer to truth, because you can apply your judgment, you can apply your perceptions and your feelings to a certain extent to the storytelling. And it has worked well in a very historical way. You know, for people like Dickens, became an agent of social change, mostly by writing fiction. I always use John Steinbeck, the American author who wrote about the Dust Bowl in the Midwest and the terrible exploitation of poor people in the 30s, as an agent of social and political awareness and change in the United States. And so, I mean, I think fiction is a powerful tool for getting people involved and conscious of all sorts of things that are going wrong in the world and in society. So, in the sense that it is about truth and it is about reality, it isn't a whole lot different from journalism, because journalism is strictly to enlighten, but this is also to, maybe fiction is also to mobilize people in a certain way.
Do you think you mentioned, you know, objectivity and agent of change in your career as a journalist? Do you think you became an agent of change? Is that something that you strive to be when you first started out?
No, I never strived to be that. I know for a fact, I mean, it is factually true that I was an agent for change in some aspects of the justice system. I got into a pissing match on your radio, but I got into one of those confrontations with a court official back in 1979. And in a moment of frustration, I said to him, "I'm going to drag your ass upstairs into the chamber, the courtroom," because he was denying me access to documents that I was informed I was entitled to see. So I did drag his ass upstairs before a judge, and the judge said I was right, and I had access to the documents. They continued to stonewall me all along until until this pissing match ended up before the Supreme Court of Canada. And we won. And I'm not going to go into it. I mean, anybody who cares can look it up. You know, the Attorney General of Nova Scotia versus McIntyre. And it is a judgment that guarantees public, not the media, public access to information that is used by the police to justify the issuance of search warrants. A violation of privacy, a violation of all sorts of civil rights that has to be justified by an affidavit explaining why they want it. And up until I got in this row with a guy in a courthouse, they routinely refused us the right to see those documents. And that now, this is a case that's applied all over the place. Whether it was the Mike Duffy story in Ottawa or the Rob Ford story in Toronto, anywhere where you see a reference in a story about something to the information to obtain, the ITO, the information to obtain the search warrant is now a public document because of that. So that's a fair, but there are other, you know, every time you do a story that's controversial or edgy or that challenges systems, you sort of wake people up a little bit. You get people thinking, and when people start thinking, you might not see it right away, but there will be incremental changes here, there, and sometimes big changes. So over 50 years, I think I was an agent of change to a certain extent. But the important thing is you never, as a journalist, set out to be one. You set out to lay out information for people to give them the facts. And the how and the where and the why of things, and then they take it from there. But at the same time, when you look back on it, you can say, I think with honesty, that, yeah, you made a bit of a difference here and there and along the way.
And not every journalist is confrontational to a certain extent. Was that a method that you felt worked for you early on in your career, or was it just the nature of the journalism that you did that forced you into that sort of how you approached it?
Yeah, well, it's like you don't set out to change, you don't set out to confront either. You set out to exercise a constitutional right, a human right, to know stuff. You're approaching people who have custody of, who are in charge of institutions and who have control of information about the way the institutions work, whether they're commercial institutions or political or whatever. These institutions affect how we live. They use our money. They change our world. And we as citizens are entitled to know how they do it, how well they do it, and to ask them why they screw things up when it's obvious that they have. Now, sometimes, and in the best of cases, some responsible administrator or person in a position of public responsibility, whether he's a politician or a business person, they will sit down and they will explain it to you when you have a civilized adult exchange of information. More often than not, and it has become almost automatic now, that they shut you, they try to shut you down, they try to lie to you, they try to distort things, they cover up. It's becoming a default position of institutions to bullshit and stonewall the public when the public is attempting to find stuff out. That's where the confrontation comes from. At that point, you have to say, listen, it is your responsibility to tell me what is in the interests of the public. It is covered by the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. It's covered just by the norms of human decency and responsibility. So come on. And if you don't, there's nothing much I can do except make you look like the fascist that you seem to be trying to portray here. And that's when things get confrontational, and that's when people have to decide, are we going to take it to the next step and force that fella or whoever to come up with what we deserve to know. Right now, we have an enormous edifice of propaganda at play in our society in terms of these communications departments for all institutions and corporations. Once upon a time, public relations was the business of representing the public interest within a corporation or an institution and the institutional interests in the public. And there was a kind of a healthy exchange. Now it's almost entirely one-sided, where communications and public relations is for brainwashing people into believing that everything that the people who run these large corporations and institutions, everything they do is above board and virtuous. When 9 times out of 10, it falls a little short of virtue, and again, it's the job of the media and a weakened media, because we all know that the media is going through a period of disruption. But it is the job of the media, whether it's campus radio or public broadcasting or mainstream newspapers. It is the job of the media to get through all the difficulty and approach and, if necessary, confront people to find out what we're entitled to know.
On that note, what do you make of the state of investigative journalism, not only in Canada, but globally, there seems to have been a major shift in the types of stories that investigative journalists are asked to cover. What do you make of that?
Well, for one thing, I mean, we could talk all day about that, but for one thing, the ownership of the media has become so remote from the actual business of providing information. You have large conglomerates owned broadcasting places, and you have and newspapers. In the public sector, you have a government that's absolutely hostile to the public broadcaster, whether it's most egregiously the CBC. In the United States, there's a famous hostility by the political sector to public broadcasting also. So you have large forces that are interested in discouraging what we call investigative journalism, unless it's the kind of investigative journalism that really doesn't do any damage to corporate and political interests. It sort of makes the medium look aggressive and investigative and dramatic. The real hard digging, sleeves rolled up, slogging to find out who done what and why they did it, and that's expensive and time consuming, and it requires dedicated people, and it requires huge institutional support for legal reasons and financial reasons. Increasingly, that institutional support is drying up because the big business and big public broadcasters don't want to invest a whole lot of money on investigative journalism unless there is an almost guarantee that it's going to pay off with ratings. And good investigative journalism, a lot of it doesn't pay off with anything. It's like police investigation. You go down the road as far as you can, and then you have to decide, I'm going to cut my losses and get out of it. But after a whole lot of persistence, you may also end up with a major story of major importance to people. And increasingly, the world that controls, the financial world, the management world of broadcasting and media institutions doesn't want to spend the time and the money on that pursuit because it usually leads to more trouble for them, lawsuits and controversy. So the state of investigative journalism is not great. There's a lot of phony investigative journalism going on. It tries to look like the real deal. It tries to look influential and important. But then, down at the grassroots level, I think of in Vancouver, the work of Kathy Tomlinson and her Go Public unit for the CBC. That is real investigative journalism. That is being available to the public to find out what's bothering the public, where the public is being let down by the people that are supposed to be looking after their interests, and going directly to the sources of the letdown and the failure to say, how come Joe Blow, it could be as small as a, an unfair repossession of a car. A journalist goes and says, what happened there? And gets to the bottom of the story and digs down, and that's investigative journalism. Investigative journalism is nothing more than trying to get to the bottom of why something went wrong in the life of somebody who didn't deserve it. And there isn't much of that going on, and where it is going on is admirable, and it's going on in spite of a lot of attempts to suppress it. But we do need more of it. And I will say that it's starting to, there is such a need for this. It is starting to crop up in places outside the mainstream. This new phenomenon called vice on television. They're coming up with an awful lot of innovative, brave, and so-called investigative journalism. There are people just setting off on their own as freelancers. And they're going to places, and they're rolling up their sleeves, and they're risking their necks, and they're doing it, and then they're bringing it back, and they're saying, "Here, you got to do something." So it is happening in inventive ways by people, and NPR in the United States ran a series called Serial, very sexy Serial, in which some person spent a long time doing 10 one-hour radio podcasts that gathered millions of listeners about some guy who was went to prison. 10 solid hours of pursuit of that story had people riveted. So there's a massive appetite for it, a massive need for it. It's just that the mechanism in the mainstream media for delivering it is faltering. But I think we will get through that as long as the fire continues to burn in the minds and the hearts of young people who want to be in journalism.
Well, I got to end it there, but the new novel by Lyndon McIntyre is Punishment. It's an enthralling read, and everybody should go pick it up and go through it when they can. Lyndon McIntyre, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, it's a privilege to be on your network, and thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. That's all right. Well, my next guest, is a renowned actress and activist. She has had recurring roles on such TV series as Street Legal with Eric Peterson and Cynthia Dale. She's had a recurring role on Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. She has appeared on the wonderful, wonderful First Nation series North of 60 with Tina Keeper and Gordon Tutusis. She has appeared on Windy Acres, Arctic Air, Strange Empire, and the lovely, lovely, the great, great series Blackstone, featuring Carmen Moore, Eric Schweiz, Michelle Thruss, and many, many others. She has also appeared in such movies as Fathers and Sons and Mothers and Daughters, written and directed by another former guest, Carl Besai. She has featured in Legends of the Fall with Brad Pitt, Anthony Hopkins, and Aidan Quinn. Yes, yes, yes. Among many, many others. And, of course, Dances with Wolves, written and directed by Kevin Costner, for which he won the Oscar in 1991. She also directed the short film Stories from the Seventh Fire. She was a series regular on Moccasin Flats, and has had guest roles in many series, including Cold Squad, MythQuest, Tom Stone, The Englishman's Boy, and many, many others. She has a new movie coming out called Down Here, which takes place on the downtown east side, about a troubled detective works to protect the city's most vulnerable and find salvation through them. She guest stars with Dean Ray, who also wrote the movie, Teach Grant, who was the co-writer and director, Sarah Jane Redman from Alienated, Viv Leacock, Annika Gordon, and Sienna Bone. The movie is called Down Here. It had its Vancouver premiere last week at the Rio Theater. She also has one other film in the work called Hope Bridge, which should come out later this year, which co-stars Boo Boo Stewart and Kevin Sorbo. She is Tantu Cardinal, and I spoke with her from Vancouver on the phone last week. Tantu Cardinal, thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Dan.
Hi. Yes, thanks for joining me today.
Well, nice to join you.
First of all, I want to say congratulations on receiving the Award of Excellence from ACTRA. What was that like for you?
Oh, that was great. It was really a lot of fun. I think what was the most fun about it for me is how other people were all excited about it, and it got me all excited about it, and I decided, well, you know what, I'm going to celebrate this, and went ahead and the whole nine yards. And it was fun to be able to try to surmise, you know, why was this award being given to me? And because when you consider so many other people that got that award, they have a huge body of work. I mean, I've been around for a long time, but I don't have, you know, I've done, excuse me, I've been in a lot of movies, but not a lot of leads. And, you know, I guess my career could be a big Indian sneak up.
Well, know? I mean... If I remember correctly, you had your first film role in 1971. So I mean, that's a pretty long career by any standards.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, in terms of you know, a presence at peace. Like for example, I did, you know, like one of my credits is Englishman's Boy. Mm. And I was in two scenes in that. You know?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And somebody like H.R. Thompson, he's done movies, he's done television series, he's been a regular in series, and opportunities are just really different for Indigenous actors and Indigenous female actors. It's very different. Mm-hmm. Things are changing now, but where I came through...
Yeah.
It's pretty sparse, eh?
Well, are you...
But it was great. It was a lot of fun, and I had a chance to write an acceptance speech that they just let me roll on, and you can find that on YouTube.
Are you comfortable with the level of... are you comfortable with... you know, how you've been perceived and sort of the level of fame and recognition that you have, not only among audiences, but also among your peers.
I love it. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I'm grown comfortable with it. It wasn't comfortable at first. No, it just was very uncomfortable
yeah.
at first. But I'm comfortable with it now. I like it. It's a good thing. Everywhere you go, you know somebody, right?
Yeah, for sure. So this new movie down here is a lovely little film, and I'm curious if there was for you a personal connection, being in that you're an Indigenous female. And a lot of this movie has to takes place on the downtown east side, which we know is where a lot of First Nations women went missing over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if you were able to connect to the written material on that basis.
Well, I don't know about on that basis. I think something that people don't really know is that my mother lived in Skid Row area in Edmonton. She didn't take me there with her. She left me with her mother. So I was raised by my grandmother up north. But the world of poverty is not a strange thing. And the world of families broken and shattered and split apart, and we make do with what we can find around us, that none of that is new. So I appreciate the story. And I was raised by my grandmother, myself, and all around me, relatives step in for those who can't make it, you know?
Yeah. I read an interview that you gave, I think it was, I forget if it was to the Star or the CBC, but you said, for you, the most important thing that you want in your career is to be relevant, and I'm curious for you how you think the portrayals of First Nations and Indigenous people in both film and television, but in all media, have been improved upon since you started your career?
Well, there's dialogue now. there are more range of stories. The character in Down Here is a woman who's well educated. You know, so that takes us out of the moose hide, and you know, a foreign language category. Oddly enough,
yeah.
If we we did a Cree a language all in Cree, it would probably be considered foreign language in the Oscars.
Yeah.
But yes, there has been a lot of changes, and hopefully we can continue on in that direction, and keep on changing the ideas in people's heads about who we are. You know, it's really inhibiting. There really is a lot of ignorance about who we are because of the misconceptions that have been put in there, right?
Yeah. And I know another project that you're involved in, which was a project that I enjoyed watching, was Blackstone, and you played Wilma Stoney. And that, I mean, to me, I think that project hit on so many issues affecting the Aboriginal community. What was it for you about that you wanted to be a part of?
Well, it's work, and it was offered,
yeah.
And so why not? But and Ron Scott is coming from a personal experience with it,
yeah.
So it's a case of trust, in a sense, that he's going to be telling stories from a perspective that's kind of from an insider's experience, right?
Yeah.
So it's not somebody who's projecting what they imagine that community to have as a part of its being, right?
Yeah.
He's got some kind of an idea of what goes on in that community, and what he does with it creatively is completely, you know, his choices as a creator. But you know, it's a certain confidence, I think, that somebody from within the community that's telling the story.
And I, you know, in a lot of the stories I've read about you, they say that it's hard to talk to you without discussing a lot of the great activism that you've done over the years. And I know one of the big ones for you lately has been the Keystone Pipeline. And we all remember in 2011 when you and the lovely Margot Kidder went down to D.C. As an Aboriginal person, what is the biggest issue with you about the Keystone Pipeline?
Water. And Keystone is kind of a metaphor for our experience here. Yeah. Something, you know, if people say that it's hard to talk to me without getting into some issue, and that's absolutely true, because that's so much of what I've seen all the time as that I was growing up, or maybe those are the things that I've noticed, you know. Maybe that was the cellular makeup that I had, and I have absolutely no other choice but to pay attention to those things. But I've always been aware of how this outside culture has absolutely no reverence or even expectation that such a thing as natural law exists, that nature, they call it, is our relative. In my mother's language, where I originally come from, nature is not separate. Nature is a part of our breath. And it's so hugely frustrating that there's this massive society that's created by people who have decided that they are the smartest beings in all of existence. And yet, we're being destroyed by these people you can't tell anything to. And so our only common ground, our only way of being able to eventually have a conversation about what's not right, about how we got to put things back in balance, is to remember water is life, crucial to every last one of us. And with the tar sands or fracking anywhere, with uranium, agricultural farming, whatever. You know, you've got to have some respect for water. It's a finite source. And water is actually being destroyed. This finite source that is life is actually being destroyed. And that there are actually people who are trying to spread the rumor that it's not a right. Water is not a human right. You know?
Yeah. There's that big case with I think it's Nestle down in the States that's talking about that. And you know what's interesting is a lot of sort of artists and actors that I've talked to over the year, they always are involved. A lot of them are involved in activism. A lot of it's environmental, human rights, civil rights. And I'm curious if you think that being an actor or being an artist. You're attuned to a greater sense of you know sensitivity or awareness that might not be present in certain other professions.
You know what? I think maybe we're drawn to it because or what comes first, the art or life, right?
Right.
I think that. Part of our job as artists is to stand up for the human experience. That's what we're saying when we become an actor, saying, I will stand in to interpret the human experience. And so by doing that, we open ourselves up. The universe loves storytellers, I think. And so all of these experiences and nuance and wins and moments bring you human experience, right? And you got to do something with it because we don't keep our actors busy enough. You know, there's a lot of time to think.
for sure.
So you know, I think that actors are scientists, human scientists. The actors that are really serious about who we are as artists are really scientists. And it's an awesome responsibility. It really is. And I kind of go, what? When I hear, they're just an actor, you don't have to listen to them. Really? Why can't you listen to an actor? What is so demeaning about listening to what an actor has to say?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well,
next question.
the movie is down here. It's a lovely little independent film that Canada has become so known for, and that you know that we make really really good quality independent film. I encourage all the listeners to check it out. Tantu Cardinal, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Alrighty, have a good one, and congratulations on the award, and best of luck in the future.
Okay.
Alrighty, bye-bye.
Thank you, Dan. Same to you.
Cheers,
okay.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Tantu Card.
Hello, you are...